This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Well, thank you very much. And it's nice to see all of you here interested in this topic. Before we jump into that, though, I'll just give a brief outline of what I'll talk about. I'll give an introduction to what is CO2 capture and storage, and in particular, why is it important. I'll then say something about expert opinion on storage security, drawing from the IPCC special report. I'll then introduce the concept of a storage security pyramid, which is really a concept to frame the issue of security of geological storage. And in that context, I'll highlight some of the research that my team has been doing over the past couple years in this area, also pointing to future directions for my program here. And then finally, I'll say a little bit about fundamental research needs and opportunities. And this is some work that came out of a recent Office of Science, DOE Office of Science, Basic Energy Sciences study on fundamental research needs in the geosciences. So that's the plan. So to step back for a moment, where do CO2 emissions come from? We're obviously all very concerned with eliminating these emissions, and we need to understand where they come from to be able to answer that. And this is some data developed by the IEA, recent data, looking at the millions of tons per year of CO2 emitted from various activities. And if you see on the far left-hand side, this is the 2003 data, it suggests that about 40% of all emissions come from electricity generation. Looking to the future, to 2030 and 2050, it's anticipated that emissions are going to continue to grow, not only in magnitude, but also in terms of the proportion of the total emissions from anthropogenic sources. So let's now take a look at electricity generation. How do we generate electricity? And again, the bars on the middle of the graph show in 2003 that about 40% of all our electricity generation comes from coal. And again, looking to the future now to 2050, perhaps contrary to what you might expect, current projections are that the fraction of electricity generated from coal is going to increase. So today, if we look at CO2 emissions from coal, about 40% of all fossil fuel emissions are associated with this coal-fired electrical generation. What's also daunting, if you look at the graph shown in yellow, is that emissions from China, which currently are 80% from coal, are growing at an extremely rapid pace. And the thriving economy in Asia is being built on the back of coal-fired electricity generation. So this is a huge challenge that we need to find a way to deal with. And I'll say now, I don't think there's only one way to deal with this issue. There are many options, from improved efficiency to renewable energy resources. But I think that carbon sequestration, carbon capture and storage from coal-fired electrical generation, is likely to need to play an important role to the solution of this problem. So that brings us to the topic of CO2 capture and storage. Basically, it's an approach for eliminating or significantly reducing emissions from coal-fired electricity generation. And the idea is that basically you capture the emissions from the source, from the power plant itself. And there are a variety of ways of doing this, which are not going to be the topic of this discussion, but there are a variety of ways in various stages of development. So that's the first step. The next thing is to take that captured carbon dioxide, to compress it, to put it into a pipeline as a liquid and transport it to a location where it could be injected deep underground for all intents and purposes for permanent storage. So that's an important thing, for all intents and purposes. The goal is not temporary storage. The goal is to permanently store the CO2. Now, those of us who are geologists, the word permanent has a very fuzzy meaning. So basically, the idea is very, very long-term in the context of geological timeframes, storage over those kind of time periods. So what are the options? Where can we put CO2 underground? Well, the obvious first choice is probably oil and gas fields. There are both depleted oil and gas fields that can be used, and basically the idea is that you take the pore space that used to be filled with oil or gas and you replace that with carbon dioxide. Benefits there are that you know that it's a good underground container, or at least it was a good underground container at one time, because otherwise you wouldn't have had oil or gas there in the first place. And the key issue there is the buoyancy of hydrocarbons and CO2. Is there buoyant compared to brine, and consequently, without a seal on top of the formation, want to rise upwards? So anyway, oil and gas fields, a good and obvious choice. It's also possible to combine CO2 storage with enhanced oil recovery. And there are many who think that this will help with the early introduction of CO2 storage in oil fields in particular. It's also possible that gas recovery can be enhanced too, but this is much more in a research stage. So that's the first option. The second option is in what we call saline formations. Saline formations are basically the same type of rocks that you find oil and gas rises in, but that they don't have oil or gas. They're basically filled with salty water or brine, and water so salty that we today don't imagine that it would have another productive use, and therefore using those resources to store CO2 would not have undesirable environmental consequences. So that's the second choice. The third choice is in unminable coal seams. These would be coals that are deep underground that we can't imagine mining today. And it turns out that if you contact CO2 with coal, it adsorbs onto the surface of the coal, basically immobilizing the CO2. And it's also possible that you can do this in conjunction with coal bed methane production, which is a growing fraction of the U.S. Natural gas production. And much in the way that we would enhance oil recovery, similarly, methane recovery could be increased in coal beds. Again, this is a fairly developmental technology, really in the research stage. There are a number of other options that are being considered. Basalts, if you look at places like India, they don't have many sedimentary formations that would be suitable, and consequently people are interested in basalts. There have been other suggestions as well, but they're much more developmental. So just as a brief recap, what keeps the CO2 underground? Well, first, it's injected at depths of a kilometer or more. And why a kilometer? Well, you need to get to those depths to get CO2 into a dense phase where the storage efficiency is high. Basically, under these conditions, the density of CO2 will be about 3/4 that of water. And when you put it underground, you're not putting it into a cavern. It's being put into the tiny pore spaces of the rocks that exist underground. And this little image here is actually an X-ray a microtomogram that was developed showing the dark spots, the CO2, the medium gray rock grains, and the white, the water. So when you think about CO2 storage, that's actually what it would look like. So that's the first thing. It's injected deep underground. The second thing is that the primary trapping mechanism, that which we would rely on certainly during the injection phase, is trapping beneath fine textured rocks that provide both a membrane seal as well as a permeability seal. Basically, the buoyant forces cannot overcome the seal that's created by these fine textured rocks. So beyond this primary trapping mechanism, there are also secondary trapping mechanisms. In particular, CO2 dissolves in water. Once it dissolves in water, it's no longer buoyant. It actually has a tendency to sink. CO2 can also be trapped by capillary forces as water re-imbibes back into the plume at the trailing edges of the plume. You can have snap-off phenomena, which basically immobilizes the CO2. And finally, CO2 over much longer time frames can be converted to solid minerals, basically becoming part of the rock itself. So these are the secondary trapping mechanisms. And all of these are important in a longer time frame than the primary trapping mechanism. So I now want to switch to the topic of expert opinion about storage security from the IPCC Special Report on CO2 Capture and Storage. There were 23 lead authors of this chapter who worked over 2.5 years to develop this material, and were challenged continually to make as definitive a statement as possible about storage security, because obviously this is something that people are most interested in. So I'll just read you two phrases that basically describe the opinion that was developed during this process. So the first one is that the fraction retained, that means the amount that stays in the storage reservoir, in appropriately selected and managed geological reservoirs is likely to exceed 99% over 1,000 years. So basically the anticipation is if you do a project right, you pick a good storage site and you manage it according to an appropriate set of procedures, that the CO2 should stay underground. And I'll get back, the rest of my talk is going to be what does it mean to appropriately select and manage a storage site. So I'll get back to that idea because it's very important. So that's the first thing, that retention should be good. The second thing that the report concluded is that with appropriate site selection, a monitoring program, a regulatory system, and the appropriate use of remediation methods to stop or control leakage, that the local health, safety, and environmental risks of geological storage would be comparable to the risks of current activities such as natural gas storage, EOR, and deep underground disposal of acid gas. So basically, two things. It's likely to be permanent, and second, that the risks are similar to the everyday activities that we undertake in the oil and gas industry and associated fossil fuel infrastructure. Okay, so these are two fairly strong statements. So what was the basis for saying this? What was the evidence that was used to support these conclusions? So this is the sort of short list, but I think it draws upon the key points. The first is natural evidence from natural analogs. Basically, the virtual existence of oil and gas reservoirs, that is, structures that trap buoyant fluids, for millions of years, says that CO2 storage or storage of buoyant fluids should be possible in principle, so that there's no fundamental underlying reason why this shouldn't be possible. The second thing is that there are also many CO2 reservoirs, and in fact, many oil and gas reservoirs also have CO2 in them, which tells you that there's nothing particularly unique about the chemical interactions, the geochemical interactions between CO2 and the reservoir rocks that would make it that storage of a buoyant fluid like CO2 would not be possible. So this is the first piece of evidence. The second one has to do with industrial experience or industrial analogs and how these perform. And in particular, there are three that are relevant. The first one is CO2 enhanced oil recovery. This is a process that Professor Orr here is one of the world's experts on. And basically, particularly in West Texas, this practice has been taking place for nearly 30 years, and about 30 million tons per year of CO2 are injected for the purpose of extracting oil. But in the process of being injected underground, on average about 50% of it stays underground and the rest of it is recycled and then put back underground. So we have lots of experience with drilling wells, operating well fields, injecting CO2 and so forth on the basis of that experience. The second is in the area of natural gas storage. There is a mismatch between gas supply and gas demand, particularly during the winter months when demand is very high, and also daily fluctuations as well. So for that reason, there's often natural gas stored close to the point of use. And as a matter of fact, here in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's a facility at McDonald Island, a very huge facility that basically stores the natural gas that's used by the city of San Francisco. This practice has been underway for more than 100 years, using all the same using oil and gas reservoirs and saline formations for the purpose of natural gas storage. And there's a map showing the location of these storage facilities shown here. And what strikes me about this map is that the distribution of these storage reservoirs is fairly broad across the United States. It's not confined to a particular place. Finally, there's a more recent example of acid gas disposal. This is practiced in particular associated with natural gas processing. In Canada, there are many projects, and there are several large projects in the United States. And what's meant by acid gas is CO2 plus H2S with varying proportions of those gases. So all of these we have experience with, and we have actuarial data on safety, performance, and basically these activities are safe enough so that it's accepted that we continue to do them on a regular basis. So that's the second line of evidence. The third is 20 plus years of cumulative performance of actual CO2 storage projects. Now, that's not to say that any individual storage project has a 20-year history. The Schleifner project has been going for 11 years. The Weyburn project began in the year 2000. And the Insala project in Algeria began in 2004. These projects inject on the order of 1 to 2 million tons per year. So how does this compare to, say, a typical 1,000 megawatt coal-fired plant? Well, a plant of that nature would emit somewhere between 6 to 8 million tons per year. So the actual experience we have is in an order of magnitude, but certainly not as great as we would anticipate for large-scale deployment for the power sector. So these are the evidence to support these conclusions. We did get a lot of comments, though, about these statements, because if you noticed, there were a lot of caveats or qualifiers that the refraction retained would be 99% over 1,000 years if you selected a storage site and managed it right. And similarly, for the health and safety risks, the idea of appropriate site selection and so forth was very crucial. So we got the argument that, well, it's sort of like, well, if you do it right, you'll have a good outcome. You know, is this sort of a circular argument? What do you really mean? You know, and what's the foundation for the idea behind, you know, how to do a project correctly? So since the time of the IPCC special report, a number of us have been thinking about, well, what does that mean? And so here I show a framing concept for geological storage security. So the idea here is that at the very foundation of geological storage and security is that we have to have a good fundamental understanding of all of the processes, all of the transport processes, all of the geochemical interactions, the geomechanical processes, and that would then provide the foundation for the whole effort of deploying this on a large scale. And then there's much work that we can build on from the oil and gas multi-phase flow science and technology that's been developed. However, there are also new things we need to learn, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. The next thing is that site characterization and site selection are extremely crucial. The presence of a seal that covers the entire extent of the plume is a crucial requirement for safe and secure storage. So we need to find ways to characterize low permeability rocks over the spatial domain of hundreds of square kilometers that might be typical of a very large scale project for CO2 storage. The next part of the pyramid is the idea of storage engineering. We need to develop procedures to drill and complete the wells such that both during the operational phase as well as during the post-injection phase, that the wells themselves don't become important leakage conduits. We also need to develop techniques to optimize storage performance so that we can, for example, minimize the footprint of the plume, or perhaps we could accelerate secondary trapping mechanisms such as dissolution or capillary trapping. The whole science of storage engineering needs to be developed. Next on the list is safe operations. We need to learn from the oil and gas industry, from the natural gas storage industry, what kind of procedures, what kind of due diligence do we need to establish so that human error missteps in terms of procedure result in releases of CO2 that are potentially harmful to both workers and the public and the environment. Next is that we need to have a monitoring program. to be able to demonstrate that, in fact, that the storage project is performing as you expected it to perform, I think that's really a crucial thing. And particularly in these early stages, as people grow in familiarity with this process, having monitoring data is absolutely crucial. And certainly with regard to the Schleipner project and the Weyburn project, the availability of publicly disseminated data, both to the scientific community and to the public at large, has been extremely helpful in advancing the state of the science and the state of understanding about what happens when you put CO2 underground. So both the technology is going to be crucial, as well as what's done with that information to provide it to people to reassure them that that oversight and monitoring is occurring. So that's so far up the hierarchy. Well, what happens if something goes wrong? You know, even very well-designed systems, even highly effective organizations sometimes make mistakes, and so something can go wrong. A well could leak. There could be a fault that you simply didn't detect when you did your initial characterization. So we need to be able to have a remediation program in our back pocket, basically, something ready to go. And there are certain forms of remediation that we know quite a bit about. For example, we know that stopping injection, for example, would reduce pressures and might help stop a leak. We know how, if groundwater were contaminated, we would know how to extract that. Actually, CO2 would be easy to pull out of a groundwater system, so we know how to do that. But we also need other ideas. We need to increase the portfolio of remediation options. The next on the pyramid is regulatory oversight. We need an institution that basically makes sure that there's due diligence across this entire spectrum of these critical elements of this concept for storage security. And then finally, there needs to be some mechanism for financial responsibility, not so much in the short term, because that's going to be easy. We'll have somebody, we'll have an operator at the site, we'll have people storing their CO2 at this site that are clearly identifiable. But in the long run, what happens if 100 years from now, a storage site starts to leak unexpectedly? What do we do? We need to make sure, number one, that somebody is continuing to monitor that site, and number two, that there are resources available so that it could be fixed. And this is turning out to be one of the most interesting issues. I as we got into this, I didn't realize how important the social science domain was, because at this time, I think the single biggest impediment for the companies in terms of investing in this kind of technology is the lack of clarity on a long-term financial responsibility model, be it some kind of insurance or whatever. And I'll say a little bit more about that at the end of my talk. Okay, so by way of analogy, you know, people often say, well, is geological storage safe? And it's a very difficult question to answer. Is driving safe? Well, your first thing might be, well, of course, or you say, no. Well, what makes driving something that we're willing to do? Well, number one, we want our automakers to build really good cars. Number two, we have to take driver's training. We have to take a test. We have police to make sure that we are doing what we say we're doing. We don't let children drive. We have laws against drunk driving. So in many ways, this hierarchy of needs is very similar to the hierarchy of needs associated with making something like driving safe. So now what I'm going to do is have a little fun and talk about some of the science that we're doing in these areas, and try to give you a flavor of how we as hydrogeologists and reservoir engineers approach these problems. So the first one I'd like to talk about is for storage in saline formations. And there are some fundamental questions we'd like to be able to answer. We'd like to know what fraction of the pore space can be filled with CO2. We'd like to know how big our CO2 plume would be. We'd like to know how much CO2 dissolves. We'd like to know how much is trapped by capillary forces. And certainly, we would like to be able to develop accurate models so we can predict all of these things so they can be used as the basis of design. So to answer these questions is actually quite complex, and in particular, it it depends on the complex interplay of viscous, capillary, and gravity forces on a whole variety of scales. So looking at the smallest scale back here, and again, this being the image of the rock itself filled with CO2, there's a competition for access to pore space between CO2 and brine, depending upon the interfacial tension of the two and the geometry of the architecture of the pore space. And at this scale, maybe 20 to 30% of the pore space can be filled up with CO2. So if we go to this larger scale, or the intra-reservoir scale, heterogeneity in rocks is ubiquitous. All you need to do is look at a road cut or an outcrop, and you'll see that the rocks are variable. Well, what this does is it causes the CO2 to be diverted in complex patterns as it migrates throughout the structure, with these low permeability interbeds basically acting as barriers to flow. So we need to understand this. Another important factor is gravity. As I said, CO2 is only about 75% as dense as brine under the storage conditions. So it will tend to move upwards, bypassing significant portions of the storage formation. And then finally, if you have a dipping structure, the CO2 would tend to migrate up. So to answer these questions, we need to understand this in quite a lot of detail. And we're actually working at all of these scales using a variety of tools, from laboratory experiments to field scale pilot tests to large scale numerical simulation. But I just want to highlight one that we've been working on recently that's been quite interesting. So we just said, well, let's look at what happens when you inject a core that starts out filled with salt water and you inject it with CO2, and what does it look like? Where does the CO2 go? How much, what fraction of the pore volume can be filled with CO2? So to do this, we do experiments where we pump CO2, we pump brine, we pump it through a core, we collect it on the other side. During this time, we measure pressure gradients across the core, and we can also scan this core with, in this case, a medical imaging system. So here's some of the equipment. Here are the pumps over here. Here's the core holder. And here's the X-ray CT scanner that allows us to look inside the core. So we did these experiments, and we injected in various proportions of CO2 and brine. So here was 5% CO2, 95% brine, 10%, 20%, 50%, and so on. So one of the things that these experiments are used for is to measure something called relative permeability, which basically you use to describe the pressure buildup at the injection well, as well as the displacement efficiency. And it turns out that when you make these measurements for relative permeability, these variations are often neglected. So we started looking at that and said, wow, these look pretty variable to us. You know, we're not really sure it's a good idea to neglect them. So we set out to figure out why they were so variable, because this was a piece of rock that we thought was very homogeneous. This was sort of, you know, something that looked really uniform. And so we were confident we would get some very nice results. And so we were surprised to see this. So our goal was to use numerical simulation to figure out what was the cause of this variability. So here's a picture of the lab data, now looking just at three cases at 10% CO2 injection, 90%, and 100%. And the first thing we said is, okay, well, we know that the porosity varies in the core. And actually, this is an image of the porosity variation. So you can see it's not hugely variable, but it does vary. And because of this porosity variation, well, the permeability should vary too. So we said, well, let's do some simulations where we just vary the saturation or the permeability and porosity and see what the results look like. So these are the results of the simulation. And basically, they said, no, we can't explain any of the variability in the core if you just include these two parameters. So if you sort of squint your eyes, you can see that the color of them is pretty right, so that the average saturation is pretty good. But certainly, we don't capture any of this interesting variability, which led us to the final simulations, which said, well, we need to add another factor, another dimension. And it turns out that we need to account for the fact that the capillary pressure relationship varies across the core as well. And so when we did that, we now see that we can create images, though, well, certainly not exactly the same, they have a very similar character. So now we've discovered something, that these capillary pressure variations in the core are causing a phenomena that we now need to figure out what to do with this. Number one, is it important? We do think it's important. We think it'll lead to things like flow rate dependent flow phenomena, which is typically not addressed in the comparable oil and gas work. We think that there are grid size effects that need to be accounted for. And overall, the general effect will be to reduce how much CO2 you could actually put into the pore spaces. So this is just one example, and I'll be building a lab that can make more of these measurements to further understand this phenomena and later develop approaches to deal with it. So that's area of fundamental science. Now I want to move on to some work in monitoring that we're also doing. And I want to go back to some very excellent work. I mentioned that the Norwegians with the Sleipner project collected lots of monitoring data and made it available to the public. So the Sleipner project basically involves taking natural gas they produce from depth, they bring it to the surface, they separate the CO2, and then they take the CO2 and they inject it into a subsea aquifer or saline formation. Here's a picture of the separation facility and the gas production platform. And this is the seismic imaging data that was collected. And this is basically called 3D seismic. It's collected by, in this case, towing an array of sources and seismic sources and receivers behind a ship and basically imaging what's in the subsurface. And what happens is when you encounter something with different physical properties, it creates a big reflection. So that's what you're looking for. So these panels on the top show the baseline data. This was before any injection. And there are only a couple of strong reflections, one at the top of the storage sand. This is the storage interval. And one at the bottom. And if you look at a map view, like you're looking down, you see that there's not too many features. OK, so that's the baseline. So then they injected. This was after 3 years. And all of a sudden, you see all of these features here. Basically, it lit up the subsurface. So this is where the CO2 is. So this data was really important because, number one, it showed us that seismic imaging was going to be very effective for this kind of work. And it also showed us some interesting things, that there were lots of little intervening low permeability layers that were causing the plume to be deflected, much like that picture of those baffles that I showed you. So that it didn't just move straight up. Anyway, here's again a map view so you can see the spatial extent of the plume. And moving into the future, you can see the plume continues to grow. You can also see that if you look above the storage zone, there's not indication of leakage. So this told us that seismic imaging was going to be really great. But every time you want to go out and do this, it might cost you several million dollars. And if you're on land, it might be even more difficult because you need to go get permission from everybody to go do this. You might need to compensate them. It's very difficult to do these surveys. So what we want to do is we want to find ways to take advantage of the high degree of sensitivity of this technology, but to make it, well, number one, easier to do. But second, when you have a survey like this that's costing you millions of dollars, I mean, here you can see it was 2 years before they did one. They waited another year. They now have one in 2004. So you're doing this only every couple years. And you'd actually like to have more data more frequently like that. So what we're interested in doing is finding alternative approaches using real-time seismic monitoring. And here's just one example of how this could be done. Say, for example, that you have a CO2 plume that's going to be migrating this way. And say there's a region here, like a spill point in your structure, that you don't want the CO2 plume to go by. You sort of see this as a place where you just don't want it to go any farther. So you really want to watch carefully to make sure that nothing is happening here. So the idea here was that you would have well bores that you put sources into. And then you'd have other wells that you'd have receivers in. And now, instead of imaging from the surface, basically you get a very detailed pattern along this line or fence that's created by this array of sources and receivers. And the idea would be that as the plume moved by, or if the plume did move by, you could detect this. So the question is this possible? Is this just wild dreaming and very impractical? Well, it turns out the answer is probably no. And in part, this is because we've now been able to do an experiment that is, in essence, a proof of concept for real-time seismic monitoring. Now, this experiment wasn't quite so complicated as the one I just showed you. We only had one source, but we did have a string of receivers. And this was an experiment done in Texas at about 1,600 meters below the ground surface. We injected, in this case, about 300 tons of CO2. So actually not very much. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to watch it move across, and we expected that it was going to move up, but we didn't know how fast or whether it would move all the way to the top of the structure. So we said, well, let's, instead of doing this before and after imaging that is more traditional, that we would actually do continuous monitoring using a source here and this string of receivers. So what we would expect to happen, so this is the storage zone itself. So this is a shale or a seal here, so we don't expect CO2 to go there. Same down here. And so if we look at this pair, this source and this receiver, its entire path is only through the seal. So if things are performing like we expect, there should be no change in the seismic travel time as for this ray. And if we look at this image, in fact, that's what we see, that the travel time for this first arrival was absolutely constant throughout this experiment. On the other hand, if we look at a ray path like this one down here, which goes directly through this sort of cartoon of the plume, what we see is that the travel time, in fact, slows down initially quite rapidly and then stabilizes. So now we have this whole set of data along here. And so the question is, well, what can we learn from this? And it turns out for each of these points, we actually have data of the delay in travel time. And that's shown by here. So this is this receiver at the very top of the formation. This one was at the very bottom. This is sort of right in the middle. And what's shown here is not only the delay in the travel time, but a match to a model that was used, a very simple model that was used to try to invert this data to tell us where the CO2 went. And so this is an image based on this very, very simple inversion, which is one realization of what this data could be telling us. But there are some things that are fairly incontrovertible. Number one is early on that it moved out basically laterally. At some point, it began to move primarily upwards. And by the end of the experiment, basically, the CO2 was moving along as a thin, very thin pancake-like structure along the top of the formation. So this is the kind of thing that we would like to do to be able to monitor geologic storage projects in real time with a high degree of fidelity. So now I'm going to move to the final topic, and that is the issue of financial responsibility. And as I said, this right now is probably one of the single biggest impediments to get industry to invest in a storage project, because they don't not only know what liability they're signing up for, they don't have mechanisms, traditional mechanisms, that they would use to basically offset that liability. And to talk about this, I want to start with an introduction to a scientific approach that we're using to address this, and I'll end up with some more of the social science aspects. So I mentioned that there were a number of trapping mechanisms, these secondary trapping mechanisms. And what I didn't say is that they all have different time frames over which they operate, and they're all going to be of relatively different importance depending upon the particular geologic setting. But a cartoon was developed that basically tried to capture, at least conceptually, our current understanding of these trapping mechanisms and how they would evolve over time. So that's what's shown over here. So initially, recall, we're relying on this seal to keep the CO2 in the subsurface in the reservoir. However, over time, we begin to dissolve CO2 into the brine. We begin to have capillary trapping after injection stops. And eventually, mineral trapping can also basically completely permanently immobilize the carbon dioxide. So the consequence of these trapping mechanisms, which increase over time, is that the storage security actually increases because the carbon dioxide is immobilized. So what we don't know is the details of how quickly these will occur. And like I said, which one of them will be more important, and how does that depend on a particular environment? So the way we're trying to get a handle on this is to do model studies, basically that capture a variety of different geological conditions and use those to assess the rate of trapping. So the way we do this is that we construct a very, very detailed geological model based on well logs. We then construct a computational grid that incorporates all the complexities of these features. So for example, in this one, we have a high permeability layer at the top. We've got a number of intervening seals in the middle. And anyway, we create this, and this is what's called one realization, or one statistical representation of what the subsurface could look like based on the information we have. We then run numerical simulators. These are highly evolved, computationally intensive models that capture to the best of our ability all of the physics and geochemistry that are occurring. And so this is a typical example. This is a large-scale injection looking at the plume after 1 month, 6 months, a year. You can see all these complexities affecting movement, 2 years, 8 years, 20 years. Here, injection stops, and then we basically look at what happens after the injection stops. And this is a graph just showing the results from, well, actually one simulation on this case and a collection here. And this now looks at a 50-year time period. So we had our 20 years of injection followed by 30 years of observation. And this is the CO2 that we put into the system that remained in this grid system we looked at. When we shut off injection, some amount of it is still mobile and moves out to an adjacent block. However, if we look at the total amount of mobile CO2 in this volume, it continues to go up through the end of the injection period, but then drops precipitously because of the creation of this immobile phase due to capillary trapping and to combine together with dissolution. So there are many people studying this using analytical methods. Professor Orr's group has done some really excellent work in this area. Anyway, so if you look at this now represents not one single case, but a whole set of cases that with variable injection strategies and so forth. And basically, the green is that CO2 that's capillary trapped, yellow dissolved, and only the red part, or less than 10% of the CO2 put in here, remains mobile after a 30-year period. Now, this isn't to say all sites would be exactly like this, but this is illustrative of one particular example that we believe is representative of some important storage resources. So what does this mean now, getting back in terms of financial responsibility and how we might begin to think about developing models for insuring these projects or having collective liability in some way? So this is, again, a conceptual risk profile for geological storage, where here injection begins. And as you inject more and more CO2, the pressure builds up in the reservoir, the plume is growing, you might encounter wells, you might encounter faults or fractures. And so the risk sort of continues to grow during this early phase of the project. However, during this time, you're getting monitoring data and you're modeling. And you're continually running through a cycle of calibration and validation, so your model gets better and better. So at some point, you say, wow, we really understand this storage project. The risk levels off. And then you go to shut in your wells, your well field, and the risk profile begins to decline. And if you notice, this is about 2 times the injection period, 3 times the injection period, and eventually tailing off at some long distance of n times the injection period, of which we don't know n is, the risk of leakage or environmental harm basically would return to an initial condition. So why does this happen? Well, number one, pressure recovery. We stop injecting, the pressure goes down. Number two, those secondary trapping mechanisms that I just showed you some results about. And finally, confidence in predictive models, because not only we go through the monitoring and validation stage here, but we repeat that as the injection stops. So what then does this say about liability and financial responsibility? that in the short term, during the operational phase where we have active participation of operators, that we actually believe we understand these risks quite well based on experience in the oil and gas industry and natural gas storage industry. So it's likely that private sector instruments will work fine here, that insurance companies will be willing to write policies or companies will be willing to self-insure. But the question becomes in this period here, and there's now discussion of a number of different approaches, hybrid approaches using public sector instruments, bond funds such as an orphan well fund or some kind of a trust fund where that the storer of CO2 would contribute, say, 5 to 10 cents per ton to this fund that would be available in the future to manage any long-term monitoring that may be required and also any remediation that may be required. And this is a quite interesting area and, again, getting lots of attention. So I want to just say a little bit about fundamental research needs. That I've highlighted some of the opportunities, but this, again, it draws from a fairly extensive effort to assess the state of knowledge. The first one is to understand the influence of heterogeneity on all spatial scales on plume migration. And the benefit or the outcome will be greater confidence in our simulation models. We need to improve our understanding of the geochemical reactions, and in particular, the kinetics in these multi-phase flow systems where treating these as batch kind of reactions will give you the wrong kind of kinetics. You need to consider the spatial distribution of the various fluid phases and reactants. And on the basis of this, we could gain greater confidence in mineral trapping. Dynamic imaging of complex multi-phase flows. I showed you one example, but really this should just be the very beginning. Geomechanical and hydrologic effects of large anthropogenic perturbations. To do this in a way that really makes a difference on CO2 emissions, this is going to be done on a grand scale. And whereas certainly we can do the first project, we can do the first 10 projects, as we get so we have multiple storage projects in a basin, there may be complex geomechanical phenomena that we have yet to fully understand. So there's definitely a need for work here. And finally, flow and transport properties of seals, faults, and fractures. Heretofore, people haven't really cared a lot about seals, faults, and fractures from a hydrologic perspective in being able to demonstrate, in fact, that you have effective seals. So this just gets back to the point that the scale is large. Here's Schleipner. This is a log scale. Here's a 1,000-megawatt power plant. 6 to 8 million tons per year, so 8 times the size of the Schleipner project. All CO2 EOR in the U.S., about 30 million tons per year. Well, if we want to deal with emissions from the electricity sector, we need to be up at 2,000 million tons per year. So scale is really an issue here. So there's the need for all those research areas I mentioned. It will be important to make real advances there. So just as a final thought, I often get the question, well, is CO2 capture and storage a research activity, or is it in a pilot stage, or is it a commercial and industrial scale venture? And the answer is it's all of those. And that's a good thing, because we certainly need more fundamental research in the areas that I mentioned. However, these are, at heart, field scale flow and transport phenomena, field-scale geomechanical phenomena, and we're not going to be able to learn everything in the lab. So carefully controlled pilot and demonstration projects at an intermediate scale are going to be crucial to advance our understanding. And finally, these industrial-scale projects are needed to really test the stresses on the system associated with these very large-scale injections. And what we need to do to really benefit from these is to make sure that the data are publicly available to the research community, to the regulatory community, so that we can all learn and advance this whole endeavor. So thank you very much.
We have time for questions, but as an enticement for you, I will just say that those who stick it out through the questions are invited to come over to the GSEP offices for some refreshments to welcome Sally aboard to Stanford and to help provide some more opportunity for conversation amongst the community of energy researchers here. So, questions?
Yeah. Bert.
Suppose I wanted to put 25% of the CO2 emitted from coal-fired power plants in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
How long do you think it would take to develop the knowledge, the technology, the infrastructure to do that? Are we talking mm-hmm. about 10 years or 50 years?
I think we're talking about in between there, 20 years.
20 years.
Yeah, for 25%. Yeah. Now, whether we have the institutional will to do that, that's mm-hmm. another
that's
issue.
Different.
But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in the there's at least enough capacity worldwide for 100 years of this, and those are quite conservative estimates, and there's probably much more. Some places don't have any storage capacity, though. If you look at Japan and Korea, they really, this technology won't be available to them. If you look at India, they'll need to consider offshore. China is sort of, they do have some significant storage capacity, but it's not like the United States and Canada that both have tremendously large capacity. Russia has very large capacity. So it's somewhat variable. But yes, there's a lot of pore space available.
Is there potential for transportation of the CO2?
Yeah, there's thought of tanker trucks that would take tankers of oil from the Middle East and then deliver it somewhere and then fill them up with CO2 and take it back to the Middle East and inject the CO2. In the North Sea, the Statoil was very interested in that. They ultimately decided not to do that and put in a pipeline for large-scale CO2 injection. But yeah, people are considering it. I think it's a really interesting idea. I'm not an expert in that. I have worked on algal bacterial treatment systems for water purification, so I've had a little bit of experience. I don't know. I think it's interesting. But I couldn't, comment in a more definitive way than that. Excuse me. Right. Yep. Yep, I think that's exactly right. That one thing isn't going to work everywhere, and that's one of the reasons we're very interested in sort of these very novel sequestration schemes that have yet to be suggested.
This one, I've, and then Steve, you're next.
You briefly mentioned acidification in the context of these small-scale projects. If we were to grow these projects to, for example, 25% sequestration of CO2 emissions.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. So when you put the CO2 into these rocks, the pH, depending upon the type of rock, will drop to a sort of a range of 3.5 for silica kind of rocks. It might drop to about 4.5 for carbonate rocks. So yes, there is some acidification, but to have an it's unlikely that would cause large changes in the rocks, such that the storage integrity of the rocks themselves would be damaged. So the question then is, if it gets out into the groundwater, would that then cause a problem? Certainly you wouldn't want that to get out, but I think that if water is escaping from the storage reservoir, the bigger problem is simply all the salts in the brine, and you would be having degradation by saltwater, intrusion. So I'm personally not terribly concerned about the geochemical reactions. I'm more concerned about large-scale brine displacement.
Mm-hmm. Particularly on the social side that you mm-hmm. mentioned. When you were talking at the beginning in the title about security,
mm-hmm.
What I gather from the talk is primarily the security you were talking about was whether it leaks back up. What
mm-hmm.
about, we talked about this the other day, mm-hmm. what about the possibility of a weather generated by the injection or just
mm-hmm.
nature, a fault, an
mm-hmm.
earthquake, and then you get a catastrophic berg like
mm-hmm.
Lake Nyos
right.
in Africa,
uh-huh.
which was not this, but
right.
But then perfect storm mm-hmm. for disaster, no wind, rolled right. downhill, killed thousands of people sleeping right. in the village. One of those would probably kill this if right. it happened, so mm-hmm. we'd have to be very careful not to have it.
Right.
The question that I have is, aside from having discussed that, mm-hmm. the other issue is the instruments that you might need to ensure against that over the long term mm-hmm. involve a high degree of social commitment over the time mm-hmm. frame of hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we had known, this is exactly the same mm-hmm. issue for geoengineering, mm-hmm. dust in the stratosphere. Mm-hmm. We had known about everything we know now for climate 100 mm-hmm. years ago, what would have been the likelihood of political stability during the 20th mm-hmm. century, for which all of those social instruments mm-hmm. could be maintained for centuries mm-hmm. through world wars and other kinds right. of activities? And how much of an ultimate break is this mm-hmm. on the overall magnitude of storage that you can
right.
safely consider?
Right. Okay. So let me start with the Lake Nyos an analogy. So Lake Nyos was a very large, rapid, catastrophic release, but it wasn't from rocks, it was from a lake. And it basically resulted from an overturn of a lake, and probably that occurred because there was some sediment slumping or something. Anyway, so that was a terrible, terrible accident. Very large release. So the question is could that kind of a very large release occur from a storage site? I don't think that kind of a very large release could occur, because basically you've got a lot of resistance to flow. As you're moving up a fault or a fracture, or you're moving through permeable strata. So what made that so dramatic is it was several hours that you had 250,000 tons, you know, really, and that allowed you to create a dense cloud of CO2 that then was driven by density currents and carried to this. So I don't think that is, that's very likely. So then the question as well is, you know, sort of what's won back from that, you know, not the terrible catastrophe. So say you all of a sudden reactivated a fault or fracture, and CO2 started to move up it, and you know, and it's, it can be somewhat of a self-enhancing process because it turns from a liquid to a gas. So there are two examples of that we know about, and there's quite a bit of study. One is Mammoth Mountain, that basically there was some seismicity, and then CO2 began to move up the fault and eventually discharged at the surface. So if you look at that data record, the seismicity started much in advance of any CO2 releases at the surface. It was only when they went back and looked at these tree kills to try to sort of basically reconstruct the history that they tied everything together. And I think it was on the order of 6 months between the time that they had the seismicity and they had surface manifestations. There's a place in Japan called Matsushiro, which is another volcanic region, and that's a fascinating story. They started having earthquakes. The earthquakes started moving up. They started having uplift of the land. Then they started having all these water discharges in the springs, and eventually they had what they called water volcanoes, which were basically CO2 and water gushing from the surface. And eventually it settled down and the land subsided. And that took about a year between the time that there was this, you know, large seismicity and they started having discharges. So it's a long way of answering that if those things do happen, I think that there would be significant evident signs of leakage of CO2, that leakage was imminent. So that's kind of it on those. We're also doing my collaborators and I back at Berkeley are doing simulations to try to create releases, you know, what kind of events, and we haven't been able to do it. That's not to say we've run every scenario, because we can't, but of the scenarios that we've tried, we haven't been able to generate those. I think that, in, you know, my point of view is that the more insidious leak is the slow leak that sort of goes undetected, and it happens to be a windless day, and there's a sump or a basement, and someone encounters that. I think in terms of human health, that would be the more likely scenario. So then to go on to the issue of institutions and, you know, will we have the fortitude to sort of sustain institutional control? So one of the reasons I wanted to talk about the risk profile over time and this idea that after you stop injection, that actually the risk of bad events goes down, and then at some point in the future, which we don't know exactly when, basically the risks would be very low and consequently probably wouldn't even warrant continued monitoring. You'd have to monitor your way up to that point. But I don't imagine that you know, 100,000 years from now or 10,000 years from now or even 1,000 years from that we would be monitoring these. I think we'll, if we've done our job well, we'll monitor them, you know, maybe 20 years, 50 years, 100 years. It will depend a lot on the site. If it's an oil reservoir, it would probably be way shorter. If it's a dipping saline formation that the plume wants to keep moving, you'd probably monitor it till it stops moving. So I do think that there is an end in sight for the kind of institutional controls that would be required. So then if we look at kind of the 100-year time frame, you know, could we create institutions that with probably some government oversight that would fulfill this role? You know, that's sort of a question I put back to the social scientists. You know, we're trying to provide our part by understanding the risk profile. I don't know. Certainly 100 years isn't a horribly long time. But
more of a Superfund metaphor. When the corporations go bankrupt or out of the deal, somebody's got to pick up the cost of the deal.
That's
probably a good place to move the conversation across to Building 550, backside of the building, upstairs, where there should be some refreshments. That's the theory, and now we do the experiments. Thank you all for coming.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.